Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, I'm Carlin Appy, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome to the podcast, and thanks so much for joining me at the channel today. So I just finished talking with Noriko Manabe about her new book, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, Protest Music After Fukushima. This came out in 2015 with Oxford University Press, and it's actually the first, as you'll hear toward the end of the conversation, of two planned volumes that collectively treat protest music in contemporary and modern Japan. Now, what this book does is it takes us into, after laying the foundation with background to anti-nuclear protests and the role of music therein, it takes us into four main kinds of space that are occupied, navigated, and created by musical protests in Japan, specifically in the cases of anti-nuclear protests after Fukushima. Now, you hear us talking about these cyberspace demonstrations, festivals, and recordings, and importantly, as Manabe illustrates here in this book, each of these spaces involves particular kinds of power structures. It involves particular kinds of constraints on content and on the distribution of music and of protest voices. It involves degrees of censorship, including self-censorship, and you'll hear us talking a whole lot about that in the conversation to come. And it involves, in the words of the book, activist efforts to reclaim a voice. Now, the book is based on really extensive research that was done on trips to Japan between 2011 and 2015, which included participant observation at dozens of protests, at musical events, and attendance at those events. And you'll hear us again talking about some of that in the conversation to come. Now, what I want to especially highlight for you, and it comes up again in the conversation, is that there's a companion website that I can't recommend enough using and having at hand as you're working through the book, if you get your hands on a copy of the book and are able to read it, because what it does is it gives you the ability to really watch and listen to and experience some of the examples that are so formative in shaping the analysis of the book in all of the chapters. Okay, so with that, I'll let you get to it and just thank you so much for listening, for supporting the channel in that way, and I hope that you enjoy. And in particular, I highly recommend going to the companion website. And as you're looking at and reading about the No Nukes concert late in the book, listen to the Kraftwerk performance, or watch the Kraftwerk performance of Radioactivity, which is really super cool. I'll try to link to that in the blog post. Have fun. I'm here today to talk with Noriko Manabe about her new book, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, Protest Music After Fukushima. Welcome to the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast, Noriko, and thanks so much both for writing a really super interesting book with a really super interesting companion website we'll talk about, and also for making time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Carla, for your invitation.
Of course. So let's start with the traditional question for the channel. How did you come to the field? Why Japan? Why the academic study of Japan? And why contemporary Japan?
I was actually born in Japan. I was born in Kyoto, and I grew up in the United States. And my first phase of my adult life was actually spent working in the Japanese financial markets. I came to that because I happened to go to Japan after I graduated from Stanford Business School, and I realized that I understood what was going on much better than my traveling companion. And so I went to Japan, and I worked in the Japanese financial markets for a very long period of time. And when I decided that I had enough of doing that, I went back to graduate school in ethnomusicology and music theory. And while I was doing my studies, I became very interested in Japanese popular music. I had covered the media industry as a stock analyst in Japan, and this included record companies like Avex and Sony Music, or and Sony, the parent company itself. And so I was already familiar with the way the music industry works and the media industry works. And so studies in popular music in Japan happened to dovetail quite nicely with that. So I started my academic career by publishing a couple of articles on Japanese hip-hop. I published an article on Japanese rap and language, and I published a second article on Japanese hip-hop DJs and how they interpret Japanese-ness in scare quotes. Mm-hmm. And so I have a long-term project that looks at club musics in Japan, including hip-hop, reggae, and EDM. So I had gone to Japan in 2011 and 2012 to finish that particular book. And as it so happened, many of my contacts in reggae and hip-hop were quite involved in the anti-Negro movement, like ECD and Shingo 2 and Ranking Taxi. These were all people that I had known before. And so what they told me about what was going on with Fukushima and the anti-Negro protests really concerned me. And so the more I was there, I looked more and more into it, and I realized how crucial it was. And then, of course, living in Japan during 2012, I saw the entire movement really blossom in front of me in a very, very large and memorable way. So I felt that that particular project needed to be completed before my other music project on popular music.
Mm-hmm. So you've already said a little bit about how you came to this particular project, and that's usually what I would ask you next. But how mm-hmm. about, how did you come to this particular title for this project? The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, Protest Music After Fukushima. Where did that come from? And can you take us into that story a little bit?
Yes. Well, actually, that title is multi-layered and intertextual in two different ways. Most people will recognize that title as the Gil Scott-Heron song, right? The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, where the African-American proto-rapper is essentially talking about how African-Americans are misrepresented on TV by citing every index of television in the 1970s, you know, to illustrate that point. And there's a Japanese rapper named Shingo 2 who remade that particular track called Kakumei wa Terebi ni Usuranai, which is Japanese for The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. And what he does is he uses that premise of indexes from what is happening on television at that particular time to illustrate how the media is distorting what is going on in Fukushima, that, you know, certain viewpoints are not being presented, that people are being thrown off the air and that kind of thing by quoting everything that was going on television. So I thought that particular remake by Shingo 2 was extremely clever. And it really encapsulated the idea of my book, which is that, you know, the media in Japan isn't censored, but it's self-censoring. Mm-hmm. And there are certain choices being made so that certain kinds of certain points of view and certain messages are not getting across. And one of them is the extent of anti-nuclear protests or the anti-nuclear or opposition to having nuclear power in Japan. And that's what I mean by the revolution will not be televised, because anti-nuclear views are simply not shown to the degree that they could be in Japan, particularly on television news.
Great. And this theme of self-censorship and the relevance of the case studies that you're talking about here for how we understand and sort of historicize and also maybe theorize censorship is very much something that comes up throughout the book. And listeners to the channel might think back to and remind themselves of, if they listen to it, the interview with John Abel, whose book on censorship actually comes up really interestingly in your study as at least one other work to think with as we think about the implications of and the nature of censorship and self-censorship in this particular frame that you're talking about.
Yes, one of the interesting things that John Abel points out about, you know, censorship in the 1920s and 1930s is that most of it is actually self-censored, but one of the more insidious things that such types of self-censorship do is that it actually limits the channels of thinking or the pathways of thinking. And I think that's actually quite true in what is going on in Japan at the moment in terms of nuclear power and other political issues, because if you don't allow yourself to say or think in certain ways, then it really limits one's possibilities of discourse.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we'll get to that, I think, in detail in the hour to come. So first, what I'll do is just spend a couple of minutes laying a little bit of the foundation. So the book is broken up into a number of sections. And in the first chapter, there's an introduction that really lays the groundwork for understanding what's to come. So I'll just very briefly lay this out and then we can dive in. So the book is centrally concerned with the issue of constraints, at least as I read this here, constraints that limit people, both ordinary citizens and musicians, and musicians, of course, are citizens as well, from speaking out on sensitive political issues. And it looks carefully at how the content, the role of music, and the performance style of music in a particular social movement vary according to three parameters. You talk about the parameter of the person, the position, in the words of the book, of the person playing the music, space, the space in which the music is played. And the book looks at constraints and opportunities in four kinds of space where anti-nuclear music in particular is performed: cyberspace, demonstrations, festivals, and recordings. And we'll talk about those in turn. And also time, the political conditions that underlie the particular movement at that point in time. And you take us through early in the book three periods in the time period under study, 2011 to 2015, that have called for different kinds of performances. And we'll talk a little bit about that as they come up in the course of the study. Okay, so for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to become readers, that's a basic general foundation, but I kind of want to now dive into the meat of the book itself. Now, one of the things that I think is really interesting that comes up very early on is you talk early in the book, in the first chapter, about your decision to use the term Fukushima, right? Rather than like 311 in the title. So that's really interesting and important, and could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, I've actually personally been chided for using the word Fukushima in conference presentations. And this is why I started to think about it a little bit more. The politically correct way, if you will, of talking about Fukushima is often 311, which actually references all three disasters that happened on March 11, 2011, which were the earthquake, which triggered a tsunami, which triggered the nuclear meltdown at Fukushima. And the reason why I've chosen to talk about it in terms of Fukushima rather than 311 is because it's actually uncontroversial to talk about the earthquake and tsunami. And in fact, there's obviously a lot of sympathy for the victims of the tsunami and the earthquake. Most of the musicians, in fact, just about every musician that I know that has anything to do with Japan, has held a charity event or done something to try to help the people in the Tohoku region that was struck by the triple disaster. But it's extremely controversial to talk about the nuclear disaster itself. And therefore, I thought it's part of the silencing of the nuclear disaster and speaking of nuclear power in a negative way that I wanted to highlight. And therefore, I'm talking about Fukushima quite explicitly. Now, it's also controversial to reference the nuclear disaster in terms of saying Fukushima, because Fukushima, as you know, isn't just a nuclear power plant. Mm-hmm. Fukushima is the name of an entire prefecture. It's the name of a city, the capital city of Fukushima Prefecture, which is actually, you know, about 100 kilometers from the nuclear disaster. So, and in fact, the towns around the Fukushima Daiichi plant are actually not called Fukushima. So there's a lot of confusion about the name Fukushima. So there tends to be a fair amount of sensitivity, particularly amongst Fukushima residents, about using the word Fukushima to describe that particular disaster, because they feel that their entire homeland is being painted in shame. You know, it's become synonymous with a nuclear disaster, and, you know, who wants that with their hometown? So I think, to the extent possible, in the book itself, when I'm talking about the Fukushima disaster, I try to make it clear that I'm talking about Fukushima Daiichi rather than Fukushima, the prefecture. But at the same time, I wanted to distance myself from using 311 as if it were a way to talk about the nuclear disaster, mm-hmm. because I see 311 and the nuclear disaster as actually being quite separate politically.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And that's actually a really important point and a really useful one to think with, I think, that comes up right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. So as we move further into the book, we move into a chapter two, that looks at, in the words of the book, power structures and the financial incentives that have helped nuclear power grow since the early 1950s and have kept it in place despite widespread criticism post-Fukushima Daiichi. And what the book does is it takes us into a kind of history of this and looks at some of the most significant elements and significant events that we need to understand in order to understand as readers what drove citizens and musicians to protest and to protest against nuclear power specifically in the first place. So we have this foundation to then take us into the more contemporary examples. Now, this chapter talks a lot about the nuclear village, right? Mm-hmm. For listeners who may not be familiar with that notion and what's important for us to understand about that notion in order to understand the kind of foundation you want us to have as we move forward, can you talk a little bit about the importance of that for this case and in terms of how it motivates how you think about this?
Yes, the term nuclear village is actually a pejorative term, because the Japanese word muda, or village, here is being used in a way that connotes a certain kind of insularity and inability to get out of it. Mm-hmm. So the nuclear village is a fairly tight-knit group of people who benefit from nuclear power. And it is often described as having five pillars. Obviously, there is the nuclear industry, which involves electric power companies, the companies that supply the electric power industry, like the large engineering companies of Hitachi, Toshiba, and Mitsubishi, and their suppliers, and, you know, many of the others that are in the supplying chain or value-added chain of electric power. But in addition to that, there is the bureaucracy that supports nuclear power. And for most of the time, when people think about the bureaucracy that supports nuclear power, they think about MEDI, which is the Ministry of Industry, Trade, and Economics. Mm-hmm. And that bureaucracy at the time of the nuclear disaster was in charge of both promoting nuclear power but also regulating it. The regulation was done by the Nuclear Industry and Safety Agency, or NISA, and they were housed within MEDI, and people would come and go between NISA and MEDI all the time. So there was a clear conflict of interest there. Many people from NISA also were former electric power industry employees. Mm-hmm. So there was a certain disincentive to be that hard on their former employers. And also there is the practice of amakudari, or descent from the heavens in Japanese bureaucracies, where people who are in the ministries, when they retire, will take up board of directors positions in the electric power industries and so forth. So, you know, the board of directors in most of the electric power industries tends to have a number of ministry, you know, former ministers. So that tends to be a disincentive for anybody working in the bureaucracy to say bad things about the industries that they would otherwise, you know, become directors of later.
Right.
So that was another issue. A third pillar is the media, which received large amounts of advertising spend from the nuclear industry, not only from the electric power companies themselves, but also from government-associated agencies that supported nuclear power. And then you had academics who were often receiving research money from TEPCO or the government agencies that supported nuclear power. And then finally, you had local governments that were typically wooed and entertained by the nuclear power industry and its supporters in order to place new nuclear reactors or new nuclear sites.
Now, one of the really interesting issues that comes up here as we understand how this shapes the practices and performances that are to come and the nature of the analysis and the arguments of the book brings us back to one of the early things that you mentioned, which is this idea of censorship or self-censorship. And in fact, in this chapter, there are lots of ways of thinking about and that you help us think about the importance of secrecy and of silencing to shaping the kinds of protests that happen, the way they happen, the importance of music in shaping this, and also the kinds of protests that don't happen. And examples of that are myriad here. We won't have time to talk about them individually, but I'll just kind of mark them and then ask you to talk about one of them. You talk here about the importance of the fact that demonstrations are not covered in mass media all the time, right? And that becomes important later on. You talk about why some people have been reticent to protest, right? The high social costs, police videotaping the protests. And you also talk about, in terms of secrecy and silencing, something that we'll come back to at the end of the book, but maybe we can lay the groundwork for that here. And that's something called the secrecy law. Now, for listeners who don't know what that is and why that might be important to think about here, can you super briefly just kind of explain that? What do we need to understand about the secrecy law in this context?
Okay, the secrecy law was a law that was passed by the Abe government in December 2013. Okay. And what it, in a really, really oversimplified nutshell, what it basically says is that if I, as an academic or someone as a journalist or even somebody who is a Diet member, asks a bureaucrat or somebody in one of the government agencies a question about a state secret, in a way that is considered to be overly coercive, then that person could be put in jail for 5 years. But because whatever is a state secret is itself a state secret, you wouldn't really be able to defend yourself very well. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't know what you were defending yourself against. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a silencing law. It's been flagged by the United Nations, Human Rights Council. It's been opposed by the Japanese law board. It's been objected to by the majority of the Japanese population, amongst many other groups. Mm-hmm. But it still passed through the Diet, and then it was, you know, it's been put into effect as of late 2014.
Great. Thank you so much. And we're going to come back to that, I think, by the conclusion of our conversation. Now, one thing I want to just mark here, just to mention for listeners, because it's fabulous, is that throughout the chapters, there are references to a companion website for the book. I can't recommend exploring this highly enough. I'll make sure there's a link to it in the post that goes up with the podcast. And it's really wonderful. So as a reader, as you're working through the chapters, and this chapter is an example of that, there'll be be little icons that direct you to examples of, sometimes they are YouTube videos of performances, sometimes it's footage of protest movements. There are all kinds of things, commercials that you can go to illustrate and exemplify what's happening in the book. Shout out to the Companion website. I wish more books did this. It's totally fabulous. And I think it's integral to the experience of the book. And so thank you for that. And I think that's fabulous.
Thank you.
So as we move forward from this, and there's a lot in chapter two that explores all of these things that we're talking about, we move to a chapter that looks at, in the words of the book, the disincentives that musicians face in voicing their political opinions, right? You've already talked about the fact that nuclear power is a taboo topic for musicians, and there's a certain amount of self-censorship involved. And this chapter looks at the lives and activities of some of the people who have been active in the anti-nuclear movement. Okay, so just very briefly, there are a number of people, of individuals in this book, in this chapter, exemplifies that, who are fascinating. And one comes up here, and I'd love if you could talk a little bit about kind of what you think is significant about understanding him and his activities. And this is Sakamoto. This is Sakamoto Ryuichi of the Yellow Magic Orchestra. Listeners may be familiar with him in that context. For you, what's can you talk us through, you know, what's interesting for you about his engagement and involvement in this movement and the way that he's been active, at least in this early context, early in the book?
Okay, well, as Carla was mentioning, Sakamoto Ryuichi is probably the best known musician from Japan throughout the world. Not only was he one of the founding members of the Yellow Magic Orchestra, but he's an Academy Award winning composer. He's even starred with David Bowie Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. And he's generally a very respected figure and a revered figure in Japan. And, he's been one of the most vocal, artists in Japan against nuclear power. And there have been a couple of them, but not as many as you might think, given that 70% of the population actually opposes nuclear power. So one of the things he's done is to organize the No Nukes series of concerts, which have been happening every year since 2012. Mm-hmm. For these concerts, he invites various anti-nuclear artists to participate in the concert. And throughout the concert, between sets, there are videos that show scenes of the cities that had to be abandoned in Fukushima because of the radiation, or artistic videos that are made by Abanoto or other artists that depict an anti-nuclear view in a very artistic way, or interviews of activists working against nuclear power or for renewable energy. And so it's a very educational as well as, very musical and very enjoyable kind of festival. And he's also attended and participated in street protests, including the weekly protest that takes place in front of the Diet, which has been going on since March 2012 and is still going on, which is quite remarkable, 4 years later. And he's also participated in the quarterly they happen about 3 or 4 times a year. There are various large protests that typically get anywhere between, a couple of thousand to as many as 170,000 protesters that are run by Sayonara Genpatsu or Goodbye Nuclear Power. And he's spoken and even played at some of their demonstrations. So he's been quite active in the field. Mm-hmm. And one of the really horrible things that happened to Sakamoto was that he gave the speech at a Sayonara Genpatsu demonstration that attracted 170,000 people in July of 2012. It was certainly one of the largest demonstrations that took place in 2012 and probably one of the largest ever in Japan. And one of the things he said was that It's just electricity, or it's only electricity, and we shouldn't be endangering the environment or people's lives over just electricity. And so what the pro-nuclear people on Twitter focus on was the fact that he said it's only electricity. Mm-hmm. And they went on a Twitter, you know, rampage, you know, bashing him over this, saying that here's this guy who made his name being a technopop artist. Isn't this kind of ironic? And essentially mocking and making fun of him in a really bad way. And this trolling was quite bad enough, but it was then legitimized when the Sankei Shimbun, which is one of the largest national newspapers in Japan, printed a front page editorial mocking him as an old man chasing a fad. And that kind of legitimized all this trolling. So negative articles about Sakamoto came out in a number of magazines that are picked up by salarymen. And you know, it was just a terrible kind of very personal and nasty kind of bashing that went on. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So anybody who actually comes out very positive or very negative on nuclear power and for exiting nuclear power can be humiliated and shamed in a public way like this, even if they're, you know, one of the most revered musicians in Japan. You know, there have been other incidents that have been mm-hmm. quite nasty, but, you know, unverifiable where, yeah, I don't think I want to say this on the air, actually.
Okay. No problem yeah. at all. So what I'll say is that there are, he's one of several examples in this chapter of people, of musicians who have spoken out in various ways, and who have been educators, right, in various ways. So you've already mentioned Shingo too. There are other people in here. So this is a really beautiful way, I think, in this chapter of appreciating musicians as educators, as well as other kinds of things, right? This is not just, I just think it's really good to think with, right, in this context. And you introduce us to a lot of really, really fascinating people, and he's mm-hmm. one of them, but also introduce us to, as you just mentioned, the consequences for a number of these people of speaking out. And this is one of the reasons why the next phase of the book becomes so interesting and so important, right? So we could spend another hour just talking about this chapter, but what I'll do is kind of move us into the section of the book. This is section two that looks specifically at spaces of protest. And there are four major spaces, and I talked about those a little bit at the beginning of our conversation. So the first space that you look at here in chapter four really, I think, helps us understand some of the ways that musicians, performers, but also ordinary citizens have used this kind of space as a way to try to negotiate voices of protest in a way that is a little bit safer from some of these repercussions, including repercussions for, you know, saying things that were not intended in the way that they were taken up, like this, it's only electricity.
Yeah.
Now, chapter four looks at some major ways of overcoming this kind of silencing we've been talking about. It talks about the importance of the openness that cyberspace creates, of mobile accessibility, and the kind of interplay between real and cyber spaces that happens in terms of making particular pieces of music available, in terms of communication across those realms and blurring of those realms. And it also talks about the ways that cyberspace actively enables participation and actively gives music this kind of mobilizing force. And you talk about some examples therein. And you also talked, I think, already a little bit, I don't know if this was before the recording or during, about the fact that cyberspace enables a kind of anonymity that safeguards a little bit of what's going on here. So for you, just kind of briefly, what looms largest for you in your mind about the importance of cyberspace as a kind of space in terms of pushing back against this silencing and secrecy?
Well, the most interesting part for me was that there tends to be a greater preponderance toward using the internet anonymously or pseudonymously in Japan than in the United States or Korea or other countries. Mm-hmm. And And the impact that it has is actually quite large, because the so-called spiral of silence, which is a concept introduced by Noël Neumann, tends to be stronger in Japan than in the United States or in other Asian countries even. Mm-hmm. Meaning that if somebody thinks that society at large, or even the community in which they live, or even the person that they're talking to, is not going to agree with something that they're going to say, then they will typically stay silent about it, particularly if they are women or people in lower positions socially. And what cyberspace actually allows you to do is two things. One is it allows you to interact politically using a pseudonym. And at least according to data that was taken in 2010, it appeared that about, you know, that as many as 78% of the Japanese population who had a Twitter account had a pseudonymous Twitter account. That meant that people could actually say things that they would not typically say to a coworker or a family member, even, or a friend on the internet. And in so doing, people were actually able to find like-minded individuals. Mm-hmm. And in that process, social media actually helped to build a lot of affective momentum toward a particular cause, which I think a number of other writers on social movements has also talked about. And music was also a very important part of building that affective wave. Mm-hmm. So one of the examples I talk about in this chapter is Saito Kazuyoshi's It Was Always a Lie.
Yes.
That particular song came out on April 7th, 2011 on cyberspace, and he tried to upload it, or somebody uploaded it, in a way that was supposedly an effort to be anonymous, because Saito Kazuyoshi is wearing this big cowboy hat and he's wearing sunglasses, and it's hilarious. But of course, he's singing a version of his own song. But the particular song that he sang was had lyrics that were anti-nuclear, but the original music itself came from a Shiseido commercial that he wrote. And so everybody actually knew the song because it had been a top 10 hit, and it had been played over and over and over again as a Shiseido commercial on television. And because of that, and the fact that it was a very catchy song with a nice catchy chorus, it caught on right away. It was, you know, it was a big viral hit. 3 days later, people are singing it in the first really big anti-nuclear demonstration there was in Koenji, because it just captured the feeling that everybody had but could not express at that point in time. You know, it was 3 weeks after the disaster at this point. People felt they couldn't go out anymore. Concerts and things were canceled. You couldn't go out to enjoy the cherry blossoms, because you weren't supposed to be enjoying yourselves when so many people had been suffering because of the triple disaster. And it just allowed people to say, yes, there's just something wrong with the way that this is being presented, and we need to speak up. You know, the music really captured that feeling that everybody really had but could not say. And it really built that momentum in a way that I think just a Twitter feed would not have done on its own.
Right. And Twitter, and you've mentioned Twitter at least a couple of times now. Twitter actually becomes a really interesting actor, just kind of infrastructurally throughout this story. So listeners who are particularly interested in that kind of social media as infrastructure and mobilizing tool aspect of what's going on here will find a lot in the book to think with and to work through. And we'll get to some of that in a moment as well. So after looking at cyberspace as a particular kind of space, you take us then into the practice and nature of music and demonstrations in a series of linked chapters, 5.1 through 5.4. Now, one of the points that is made very powerfully here in this series of chapters is that music is important here as a way to reclaim urban space. Right. Because that seems so central, could you talk a little bit about what you take to be some of the most important aspects or aspect of that for us to understand about that notion, music as a way to reclaim urban space and demonstration?
Well, urban space is kind of in short supply in Japan, generally speaking, but especially in Tokyo. And urban space for political contention in particular is in short supply. In the United States, if you want to have a huge demonstration and make an impact, you stage a million person march on the Capitol and you park yourself in the Washington Mall, which is a huge amount of space. You know, it would allow a million people to mill around. Certainly during Tiananmen Square in 1989, there were hundreds of thousands, if not millions, who were parked, in front of the Forbidden City in Tiananmen Square. And so what happens in Tokyo is that the urban space that are near the power centers are actually quite regulated. There is a boulevard that goes up to the Diet Building, but it tends to be heavily policed when there are demonstrations that take place there. The police will often make all the demonstrators keep themselves to the sidewalks, which actually creates an almost dangerous level of overcrowding. And there's just a lot of policing and buildings that make it very difficult to stage a very, very large and visible demonstration in a city, in Japan. So, a lot of what demonstrators are trying to do is, they're trying to reclaim a certain amount of space in the city by creating a certain level of chaos in the city within limits. And so that is part of what is going on with the Shiroton around revenge of the amateurs, as some people would say, demonstrations that took part in the early part of the anti-nuclear movement in 2011. This is a group in Koenji, which is a bohemian neighborhood in Tokyo that has been, quite interested in social movements for a long time. They're basically trying to use kind of a carnivalesque way of attracting attention from bypassers by featuring music on several different trucks. There are rappers, there are punk rock bands, there are street chindom bands playing playing within the march, so on and so forth. So part of this is just using the sound to let the sound travel beyond the buildings and beyond the lines of sight, to let people hear the contention. So that's part of what is going on. And the second part, of what is going on is just to simply be a presence, in front of areas of power, despite the fact that there are all these police that are blocking up, all the areas where people could congregate. So that's part of the point, behind the weekly demonstrations in front of the Diet. It's about occupying space in front of the Diet.
Great. Thank you so much. And there's a chapter 5.4. And speaking of sound occupying space, you can hear "O Canada" being blown by the ship outside my window right now, possibly, of sound creating a particular kind of nationalistic space here, for example.
Yes.
In chapter 5.4, you really, I think, beautifully and in a very detailed way take us through some of the particular aspects of this urban space that constrain or enable certain kinds of musical protest, including the nature of the district, the roots, the aspect of boundaries or edges, intersections, landmarks, sound marks. And if we have time, we'll get to a couple of case studies that illustrate some of the distinctions there and the different ways that can happen. But first, what I want to do is just make clear for listeners, some of the examples you just talked about are take up the analysis in the central part or the center part of this fifth cluster of chapters. These are parts that you use to talk about sound demonstrations. And 5.3 actually looks at after laying the foundation of the history of the emergence of sound demonstrations in 5.2 and the origins thereof, 5.3 looks at the ways that sound demonstrations are actually developing and changing in the context of these anti-nuclear demonstrations. Now, you show here there's a kind of change, a sort of evolution from what you call a presentational format of musicians delivering mm-hmm. prepared songs to a participatory format in which rappers are more kind of engaging protesters in different ways. And we'll talk about that as well. So let's actually go right into that. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the particular characteristics so listeners can understand why these distinctions and this evolution are and is important. So presentational, you talk about, or there's a lot of attention in this part of the book toward presentational examples here. What is an example, perhaps, of a presentational format, and what's distinctive about that before we move to participatory?
Okay, I'm taking the terms presentational and participatory from Tom Torino, whose 2008 book actually lays out these particular definitions. And my contribution to this particular dialogue is that the participatory versus presentational is actually a continuum of performance practice, and protest musicians will veer from one toward the other depending on what the political circumstances are. Mm-hmm. And what a presentational performance is that there is there's a very clear division between the performer and the audience. The performer is singing and the audience is listening. So this would be, for the extreme example, for example, is if you were to go to the Metropolitan Opera. You're not going to be singing along.
Well, maybe you're not, right? Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not going to be singing along unless you know you're listening to Verdi's Nabucco or something. But anyway, so that would be an example of something where you are the audience. You're listening to an opera singer singing at you. A participatory performance is somewhere where the audience is actually part of the performance. So an extreme example of that would be, you know, for example, if you were to go to an Irish bar in New York City, a lot of times the entire audience is actually also the performers, and they're kind of coming and going and playing along a couple of very simple tunes. A kind of participatory performance that often occurs in protest is a drum circle. So typically we had drum circles that occupy Wall Street. We have drummers in most demonstrations, post 2011 demonstrations around the world. And we've had a very active drum group that has been drumming in every single demonstration in Japan practically since 2011. Mm-hmm. And the kind of, it's participatory because anybody can join in, and they're very simple rhythms. The point is not to make aesthetic music as much as get as many people as possible to participate. There isn't that much of a line between the audience and the performers. And so what has developed in Japan, actually out of these drum circles, is a kind of call and response pattern where you're not just doing a call and response of slogans or shrekcore, as they're called in Japan, we don't want nuclear power. But what you're getting is a kind of a musical version of shrekcore or call and response pattern where you're basically saying these slogans to the beats of the drums. And then that kind of style actually developed to be a kind of rap where the rappers will do a little bit of freestyling and then they'll say a couple of slogans over rap beats, over beats in a rap style. And then the audience or the protesters will rap back to them. So in that kind of performance, there's really kind of much less distinction between who is the performer and who is the audience in that kind of case. And that kind of participatory performance tends to be quite powerful in protest because it makes everybody feel involved. It makes everybody voice, you know, the claims that they want to make against the government or make against nuclear power.
Great. And so this chapter, I think, really beautifully takes us into examples of this spectrum between presentational and participatory modes. And you talk here about, and I'll just name this and then we'll move on, this sort of evolution that happens as the movement shifts its focus. And this is between, you know, 2011 and 2013, from raising awareness to mobilizing citizens, from expressing discontent to a desire to actually change national energy policy. So there's a really interesting movement there. And then finally, at the end of this cluster of chapter 5.1 through 5.4, as I mentioned before, there's this really interesting look at music and urban geography. And we won't have time to talk about this in detail, but I just want to mark for listeners that there are two interesting case studies here. You talk in detail about Twitno nukes, so bringing us back to Twitter, right, and the mobilization that Twitter enables, and also no nukes, more hearts, and talk about the different ways of using sound to navigate and create urban space and urban geographies in these examples.
Now, yes, could I just?
Of course, please.
Just say, okay. Chapter 5.3 is basically an exploration of the so-called sound demonstration, and what a sound demonstration in Japan is actually quite unlike demonstrations that you might see in other parts of the world, in the sense that there are quite musical entities. So, for example, you might have a truck that has a reggae singer and rapper. You might have another truck that has a punk artist or a rock band or other kinds of actual live musicians on it. But the word sound demonstration is actually means a demonstration with a sound truck, mm-hmm. which is a truck with a sound system that might have some of these kinds of artists. And what was very interesting to me was at the very early stages of the anti-nuclear protests, you know, particularly in 2011, was that the music tended to be so-called presentational, in the sense that Ranking Taxi, a reggae singer, would actually come up and sing an entire song. And he'll have a call and response pattern embedded into that song. But most of it was really him singing and people listening as they marched along. By 2012, and that was appropriate in 2011 when people were still not comfortable with speaking out. They had this kind of dull feeling that things were bad. But they were at a state when they actually wanted to listen to somebody tell them what was wrong, the nuclear power. By 2012, many people had, you know, started to believe the nuclear village argument against nuclear power. And so at that stage, what you actually wanted to do was not convince people that there was something wrong as much as get people to become more involved in the movement. And so the participatory mode of sound demonstrations was much more apt for that particular stage of the movement, because many people were already against nuclear power. What you wanted people to do was to voice their opposition to it. So this kind of rapping pattern of the rappers stating a slogan and then the protesters responding to it in rhythm, that kind of participatory style was much more appropriate for that that stage of the movement.
Thank you so much. Now, as we move sort of further into the book, we're also moving further toward our conclusion, and we won't have time to talk in detail about a lot of the interesting things that are happening here. But again, I just want to kind of point this out and name this for listeners, so that when they get their copies of the book, or their hands on a copy, they'll know they can explore this. Now, Chapter 6 looks at another space. This is the space of the festival, and it takes us into different ways, focusing on three particular cases of different ways that political ideas can be communicated by approaches taken by festivals. You've already talked about the No Nukes concerts, and that's yep. one of the examples. The chapter also looks at the Atomic Cafe at the Fuji Rock Festival, and it looks at a very different kind of festival called the Project Fukushima Festival. These are three different kinds of events doing three very different kinds of work. And again, we won't have time to talk in detail about them, but it's a really interesting and important part of the study, I think. Now, after that, we have a chapter that looks at recordings, this the fourth kind of space. And it looks specifically at the complex layers of self-censorship that are happening in recordings. Mm-hmm. Now, nuclear power, of course, is a taboo topic, so musicians rely on different ways of shaping their medium and shaping their music to get their views across. You talk about allegory, you talk about metaphor, and you talk about metonym, as it's used by a number of different kinds of artists to do this. Now, just to give listeners a very brief taste of the kind of thing that they'll find here, do you have a particular example of an artist who's doing this, using allegory or metaphor or metonym as a way both of self-censorship, but also as a way of communicating despite these prevailing silencing issues that you talk about in the book?
Yes, well, one of the more poetic responses to this was one by Kururi, which is a Kyoto-based rock band. Mm-hmm. And the members of Kururi have been quite active in relief efforts in the Tohoku area since 3/11. They visited a lot of the coastal towns that got wiped out by the tsunami. And so one of the songs that they have on their 2012 album is called Soma. Soma is the name of a town that is on the coast of Fukushima that was badly hit by the tsunami. And it's actually an ode to all the towns that have become tainted or irretrievable because of nuclear power accident. About 160,000 people had to evacuate from towns that were close to Fukushima Daiichi, and many of them still have not been able to return. And so this is actually an ode to these kinds of towns. And so through both music and words, Kishida, the leader of Kururi, is actually evoking the scenery of this lost town that people can't quite return to. You know, so the cymbals seem to evoke the waves. The trumpet seems to evoke a soaring sky, you know, as does a steel guitar. It's a very, very poetic and very subtle kind of way of drawing attention to the crisis.
Great. Now, as we move toward our conclusion, we also move to the conclusion of the book. Chapter 8, which functions as the conclusion, looks at the continuities between the anti-nuclear protests that make up the central part of the analysis of the book and later protests. And specifically, it takes us into the continuities and contrasts between these anti-nuclear protests and the movement opposing the secrecy law. Now, we opened early on talking about the nature of the secrecy law. Can you close for us as we move toward our conclusion of our conversation by talking about this transition for you? What are some of the most important aspects of these continuities or not between the anti-nuclear and the secrecy law protests?
They're quite similar in terms of actual musical content, in the sense that the centerpiece of the so-called SEALS protests, which are student protests that have happened since the secrecy law was passed in 2013, many of them involve sound trucks, they involve rappers, and they involve this kind of call and response pattern. The one thing that is different between the anti-nuclear protests sound demonstrations and the SEALS sound demonstrations is genre, because the SEALS demonstrators tend to favor certain kinds of 1990s hip J-pop. They tend to play a lot more EDM than the people from the anti-nuclear movement, who tended to play more kind of funk, you know, 70s rock and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, but the technique is and general style is actually quite similar, which is that you're doing a call and response pattern of slogans. Mm-hmm. What is interesting about the SEALS movement, which actually spans two issues: the first being the secrecy law, but the second is the protest against the Abe government's, shall we say, remilitarization of Japan by promoting so-called collective self-defense of Japan for its allies, making it possible for Japan to send troops overseas for the first time since World War II. That's really what most of the SEALs protests are actually about. But the thing that is different about the SEALs protests is that, A, it's been very well covered in the press. And the second point is that one of the reasons why it's been very well covered by the press is because students have been involved. These are college students who were largely absent from the anti-nuclear protests. Mm-hmm. And they've been led by a couple of very charismatic students within SEALs who are also quite photogenic, which I think has helped to bring them a lot of media attention. But it signals kind of a new phase of social movements in Japan because the young people are involved and because it's getting a lot more media attention than it had before.
So thank you so much for making the time to talk with me today. We're now kind of in our conclusion. And I just have a couple of things I want to ask you. As we move toward our conclusion and we move now to the end of the book, this is not the end of this project. Now you open the book or you talk early on about the fact that this monograph is intended to be part of a larger project on protest music in contemporary Japan, which also involves a forthcoming monograph. So as we kind of wrap up, can you tell us a little bit about the book to come? What's this other forthcoming monograph and what can we expect to find when that comes out?
Okay, I actually have several projects at the moment that are related to this project. The most closely connected is a book that is also under contract from Oxford University Press that is entitled Revolution Remixed, Intertextuality in Protest Music, where I'm actually talking about the different kinds of intertextuality that one often sees in protest music, not just in Japan, but in other parts of the world. You know, you see it in the Umbrella Movement of Hong Kong, you see it in Gezi Park, you see it in lots of other post-2011 movements. So the idea is that the easiest way to get attention for a song when a movement actually starts is to reference a song that has been affiliated with another protest movement or that everybody already knows, which is what Saito Kazuyoshi does when he sings, when he remakes the Shiseido's commercial into a protest song. So that's the that's what that particular book is about. It talks about different kinds of intertextuality, and I come up with about 15 different categories, which include not only so-called cover songs, but also mashups, adaptations of a genre, metaphor and allegory, so on and so forth. So that's one kind of book that I'm doing. And then I'm also working on an edited volume called Sonic Contestations of Nuclear Power, which I'm co-editing with Jessica Schwartz, who is a specialist in the Marshall Islands. And that particular book looks at the entire nuclear cycle, if you will, from uranium mining to nuclear testing to the nuclear bomb itself in Hiroshima and Nagasaki to more nuclear testing such as the Bikini Atoll and then waste disposal. And we talk about sonic and musical reactions to each one of those stages. And then another project that I'm working on is I'm the co-editor along with Eric Drott on the Oxford Handbook of Protest Music, where we're exploring the ideas of space, place, and intertextuality or tactic from an international viewpoint. And we have about 30-some authors that will be contributing to this particular volume.
Great. And before we close, there's obviously, and it's going to be obvious to listeners, certainly to you and I, there's a ton of stuff in the book, right, that we didn't have a chance to talk about. But is there anything in particular that didn't come up or that we didn't talk about that you'd like to mention for listeners before we close? No?
Well, I think we talked only about Japan in this particular, I only talked about Japan in this particular book, but I think it's also important to keep in mind that self-censorship and censorship does not only take place in Japan. So, for example, you know, the art world globally is quite dependent on some very, very rich individuals and corporations. So it's very, very difficult to stage an art show, for example, that is anti-nuclear. It's not difficult to stage an art show that is about 311, but it's very difficult to stage an art show that is explicitly anti-nuclear. So this kind of thing is not limited to music, and it's not limited to Japan.
Well, thank you so much for making the time. It's a great book. And again, I want to also highlight the importance of the website that allows us to experience some of this music and these protests and this sonic environment that you write about so compellingly here. So thank you, and best of luck with your next work.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.